Coming to you from various places around the world, this is the Global Exhibitor Podcast, the podcast designed to help exhibitors succeed internationally.
If you plug something into an electrical socket today, that's due to exhibitions. If you ever pack something into a Louis Vuitton suitcase, that's due to exhibitions. If you use a touchscreen, if you saw an IMAX movie, if you ever had a sip of a Bordeaux wine, if you ever chugged a Pabst Blue Ribbon, 1893 in Chicago. And if you had too much of either and had a breathalyzer, that was in the 1930s trade shows in America.
Your host for the Global Exhibitor Podcast is Jeff Hanna, a designer, entrepreneur, business strategist, industry thought leader, and student of world cultures based in the United States. Here's your host, Jeff Hanna.
Well, hello, everyone. We're broadcasting live today from Las Vegas at the Great Mandalay Bay Convention Center. And what happens in Vegas is certainly not staying in Vegas right now, as this is going out globally. I'm excited today about the guest, one which I believe will be one of our best interviews so far, but you can be the judge of that. I truly believe that you're in for a real treat, as this was just an absolutely fascinating conversation with Mr. Charles Pappas. Charles is the author of a book called Flying Cars, Zombie Dogs, and Robot Overlords. He's a senior writer for Exhibitor Magazine and a frequent speaker at various conferences, including Exhibitor Live, which is how we first met many years ago. Charles is like the Indiana Jones, Captain Ahab, or Mr. Peabody of the exhibition industry. He's dug up lost photos in Shanghai and located forgotten fair buildings in Mexico City. He has spent years sleuthing out not just the economic impact, but cultural imprint of trade fairs, which is a key point of his book, which we're going to talk about more in just a few minutes. But the impact of trade fairs lasts long beyond the end of the show. But Charles has covered the expo industry for Exhibitor Magazine for many years and is the industry's de facto historian. And yes, it really is Charles here today. We're excited to be able to spend time with him, and we did take quite a bit of time in between his book signings and other events, which I greatly appreciate. He has shared lots of fantastic insights with us, and I believe that this will be one that you may need to listen to more than once to really let it sink in. And we're airing this podcast in two parts, so let's get into part one of my interview with Charles Pappas on the Global Exhibitor Podcast.
It's quite an honor to be with you today, Charles. Are you doing okay?
I am, and thank you. I'm excited to be here. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Good, me too. Well, I have, I guess, known of you for many years, and I think we did meet sometime a long time ago.
Quite a few years ago at Exhibitor Show.
Yeah. And you've been working for Exhibitor Magazine, I think, for quite some time as well as a writer.
Actually, since 2002, I'm getting close to 20 years there.
That's a good long time.
Longer than any relationship or marriage I've ever had.
That is a long time, yeah. And Charles is the author of a book called Flying Cars, Zombie Dogs, and Robot Overlords, which came out in late 2017. Is
exactly,
that right?
Exactly. Yeah.
So that book is about... And I'll let you fill in the blank for that.
Well, it's about kind of an aspect we're blind to in this industry. How trade fairs and world expos, which really are just a supersized version of trade fairs, have changed history. But it's changed it on such a level, so profoundly, that we don't realize that virtually everything we come in contact with every day hit a tipping point or was launched at trade fairs and exhibitions.
But it is, I'm sure, something that most people just don't think about, especially if they're not even in our industry at all.
No, the industry, as we all know, is invisible to people outside of it, despite being probably somewhere in the neighborhood of a $100 billion industry. But even the Wall Street Journal rarely covers it or mentions it. So then when you get down to what its effect on society is, that's even more invisible. It's just something people don't see, though it's woven into the fabric of our everyday lives, and yet we don't get the credit for it. Exhibitions don't get the credit they deserve for changing history in the last 175 years or so.
Yeah.
How did you get the spark of inspiration to do this kind of book?
Well, actually, it was when I was 9 years old, when I was at the New York World's Fair in 1964. But that interest had lay dormant for several decades. But when I went to work at Exhibitor, I was put in charge of the archive column, among other duties there. Now, that's where we print a photograph and run some text of old trade shows. Well, I really got into it. I began to dig and dig and dig. And that's when you sort of realize that trade shows overlap with world's fairs. And not only do they overlap, but just about every invention you can think of, from the Ouija board to the Walkman to Jemima pancakes to the electricity we use in our houses, came by way of trade fairs and world expos. Well, that became a burgeoning interest of mine that I wrote a lot about in the magazine and in the column. And then in 2010, the magazine thought, we're going to expand our borders. We're going to start actually doing the world's fairs now. So my boss, Travis Stanton, and I attend the world's fairs now every time they occur. So we've been in Shanghai in 2010, in South Korea in 2012, in Milan in 2015, Kazakhstan 2017, and in 2020 we'll be in Dubai. They're the most extreme form of exhibiting you can find. The Shanghai one, for example, was on the grounds the size of Monaco. We traversed that every day. It was monumental. But the reason it was worth going to is this. Just as trade shows may be B2C or, you know, B2B, world's fairs are B2C, business to consumer, but also what I call C2C, culture to consumer, where businesses and governments are actually trying to sell themselves, the idea of themselves, to consumers, to people who see these things.
Yeah. It makes a whole different dynamic, right?
It does.
And I know that you've seen some of the projects that my former company that I was part of, Gielsen, or Gielsen, for those of you listening who speak Dutch, we've done a lot of those pavilions, especially for the Dutch government at the World's Fair. So.
Which are among some of the most inventive there. Keeping with the Dutch as a country that punches above its weight, well, they do the same thing in their pavilions too. Remarkably historical, remarkably inventive, and playful, which I find just fascinating about Dutch culture, but it's represented easily in their pavilions. Yeah. And they understand something about World's Fairs, which I like, and which the Chinese knew, which is why they had it in Shanghai. It's a projection of soft power, which is exactly what the Chinese spent apparently up to $90 billion in infrastructure renewal so the world could see that they are on the world stage now.
Yeah.
We used to do this in 1893 in Chicago, in 1939 in New York, 1964 in New York, and even in 1876 in Philadelphia. We had world's fairs because we understood they would project our image of ourselves to the world and establish a greater foothold in the world.
Fascinating. So out of all the world's fairs that you've studied and or ones that you've attended even, which one do you think stands out in your mind the most? And then I'm going to ask about which country pavilion is, you know, stands out most in your mind.
Of the ones I've attended, Shanghai, because again, you saw a superpower at work and just the scope of it. They not only was it on grounds the size of Monaco, they made sure it was the biggest in world history. They were doing many things that were subtle and sometimes overt to, again, project that power. But the greatest of all is the 1889 Universal Exposition in Paris. That was when the Eiffel Tower went up. That was when Edison had 25% of the American presence there, showing everything from the phonograph to the telephone.
Wow.
It was a remarkable situation there because the Eiffel Tower should have been torn down. It should never have gone up, to be honest. It was hated at first and yet became one of the most beautiful icons in the world. One of the first structures that was actually going to go up instead of the Eiffel Tower was a 1,000-foot-tall guillotine.
Oh, my.
Because they were celebrating the 100th anniversary of the French Revolution, and what symbolizes that better than a guillotine?
Mm-hmm. Well, for some reason, that never got made.
And apparently, I've heard stories. It would have been a working model, which I really shudder to think about. But when the Eiffel Tower finally went up, again, it was detested. It was called a tragic street lamp. Mm-hmm. It was, in fact, the French intelligentsia published an article in the newspaper in which they said it was so ugly that even barbaric Americans would understand how disgusting it was.
Oh, my goodness.
But again, it went up, became a symbol of progress, because it was. It was unlike French architecture to that time. Of course it
true.
Was.
Yeah.
And what it did, and Eiffel, by the way, did something kind of fascinating. Because the people who ran the fair, the show organizers, thought that it would go down within 20 years, that was the deal,
mm-hmm.
and maybe even sooner because they thought it might be so ugly, Eiffel said, I'll shoulder most of the cost of this if I can have the concession rights. They thought, no brainer. It won't even last that long.
Right.
We're going to get the better end of this deal. He made millions and millions from it.
Yeah.
Other than that, I'd say 1851, the first World's Fair in the world, in London, because they created the Crystal Palace,
yeah.
which was essentially the granddaddy, the DNA of every convention center, from the Javits Center to Moscone to McCormick Place. All of them owe a heritage to that one
right.
design.
Yeah,
and that's the modern exhibition center.
Yeah. I remember studying the work of Gustave Eiffel when I was studying architecture in college, and also the Crystal Palace as well. That was one
Joseph
of the iconic
Paxson,
pieces.
Yeah. A horticulturalist and greenhouse maker.
Yeah.
Who... He took it upon himself to design it because they were actually holding a competition for the design of the main exhibition building. They had 245 entries. All were rejected because they were so boring. With 2 weeks left before the deadline, the clock's ticking. This guy Paxton thinks, I can do this. He doodles on a scratch pad his design based on the Amazonian water lily named in honor of Queen Victoria. It was the first real example of biomimicry in architecture. They accepted it immediately and unanimously because it was so simple, so beautiful, so outstanding that would show Britain in the forefront of the world. So it took about 9 months to make, 1,848 feet long, 408 feet wide, 10 stories high. It held 14,000 exhibitors and it could handle 8 miles worth of display tables. This is with 1850s technology. He based it again on the water lily. Instead of these strong spines, he used iron rods and then 293,000 panes of glass that fit in between the rods. It was simple, elegant, and it was prefab also. It was decades and decades ahead of its time.
Yeah.
It was beloved, actually, unlike the Eiffel Tower. It was beloved immediately. But, you know, it again set the standard for the exhibition industry.
That's quite amazing, actually. A lot of backstory there that you've obviously done a lot of research, and I can tell it's a passion of yours. It's really, really fascinating. What would you say is the most compelling or important idea that you're trying to communicate to people through your book, at least, and maybe you're doing that in other ways through talks and things like that, but what is it that you want people to know as a result of having read the book or listening to one of your talks?
I want them to come away with three simple words. You make history. Every day in this industry, like any other job, it can be boring. It can be a grind. You're doing paperwork. You're filling out forms. You're handling angry customers. But when you look at this, you realize if you look at it from the bird's eye view, from the satellite's eye view, you realize you are part of history. You have made enormous history. You are making enormous history. I love if they can remember some of the stories I tell, the ones that interest them. But more than anything, I want them to walk away knowing they make history.
That's a great idea, and it certainly is. I've said myself on occasions that it's hard to have a perspective, a historical perspective on what's happening in your current, you know, situation or whatever, until you get past it a little ways and then look back exactly. and see, like, that was a significant point in my life or a significant point in my career or family or whatever. And it somewhat takes that perspective of time, I think, to shed light on that those events and see how significant they really were.
Well, for example, if you plug something into an electrical socket today, mm-hmm. that's due to exhibitions. If you ever pack something into a Louis Vuitton suitcase, that's due to exhibitions. If you use a touchscreen, if you saw an IMAX movie, if you ever had a sip of a Bordeaux wine, that was officially introduced at the 1855 exposition in Paris. If you ever chugged a Pabst Blue Ribbon, 1893 in Chicago. And if you had too much of either and had a breathalyzer, that was in the 1930s trade shows in America. There is virtually nothing you can encounter in your day-to-day life that was not launched or, as I say, hit a tipping point at exhibitions.
Yeah. I remember, I think it was Dover that did the elevator exhibition, and I want to say it was Chicago.
In New York. In 1853, it was Elisha Otis.
Okay.
Elisha Otis.
Yeah.
Who, and no, at that time, actually, elevators were had been around for actually almost 20 centuries. The Romans had used them, mm-hmm. Of course, to lift animals up from beneath the Colosseum into the Colosseum to fight gladiators. So elevators, manual elevators, were well known. Yep. And they always went up, but unfortunately, they also went down a lot fast and hard mm-hmm. because the ropes and pulleys would snap. Otis's innovation was a safety catch, but how are you going to popularize it? So at the 1853 World's Fair in America, the first one in the States, and it was in New York City, he created a minimalized elevator, raised himself two stories above the crowd, held the rope holding it, and then snipped it in two. People in the audience shouted because, of course, there's no reason for this not to fall.
Yeah.
But it did. Nothing happened. What he did was exploit, I think, one of exhibition's greatest powers, the ability to hold a live demonstration that could end in catastrophic failure because it's real and it's live. There's no fakery involved. Now, from that, within 20 years, he was actually selling about $1 million worth of elevators in those days, money in those days.
That's huge, yeah.
Now, today, I think they have about, Otis has about 1.5 million elevators and about 100,000 escalators in operation at any given time around the world. Now, I know there are other elevator makers out there. I can't think of a single one. I can't think of a name for a single one. Otis, for 170 years, was branded in the public imagination because of what he did at an exhibition. There are many, many brands who have done that and just grabbed the mantle yeah. and held it for that long because of the power of exhibitions.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And, of course, the size of the crowds, too. You're talking yeah. about sometimes millions of people who are there, not for the 7 seconds of a web ad or 30 seconds on TV, but for days at a time. In 1893, it's estimated that maybe 27% of America went to the World's Fair. Wow. 32 million went to the one in France in 1889. 45 million went to the one in New York in 1939. In 1964, about 50 million in New York. Expo 67 in Montreal, about another 50 million. And in Shanghai in 2010, 75 million people attended. That's two Californias. And you've got them for hours or days at a time.
Yeah, it's a destination, right? It's a vacation.
It's a vacation, right. It's a destination. And it's a place where you want to be exposed to these things, yeah. not reluctantly, like when you're waiting for Game of Thrones to start again or something, you know.
Yeah.
You don't have to win them over. They want to be there. And again, for those who use live demos, the sky's the limit.
So you have a very broad perspective, of course, on the exhibition industry because you travel extensively and been to many shows. So what are some of the biggest mistakes that you've observed or opportunities missed that you see happening out there?
That's a great question. One is increasing reliance on screens to tell your story and without even a good design
on the screen to tell your story. Mm-hmm. That and the fact that there's little emphasis on storytelling in whatever form, meaning a beginning, a middle, and an end to the narrative you want to present about your product or service. Usually it's in bits and pieces, and it's really frustrating to get. Second to that, I think, would be cultural differences that are not paid attention to, especially in international shows, whether it's, proxemics, for instance, the distance your staff should mm-hmm. have from visitors, to should your information be on the outside of the booth rather than on the inside, because certain cultures, especially in Germany, like to graze the outside, gather information, do the research, then later make a decision to go inside. Those are, I believe, hugely missed opportunities. But more than anything, I find it astounding that companies still do not do live demos to test their product. Again, going back to Otis, you can prove it once and for all that your product is superior to anything else if you're willing to test it. The old Timex yeah. torture test, you know, you're going to try and smash it and it doesn't smash. It works. There are so many products that could easily have a dramatic demonstration put up, but nobody does it.
And why do you think they don't do it?
I don't know if it's a question of they think it's old-fashioned. Maybe while they're enamored of the architecture of their booth, they don't think of the narrative in their booth, the storytelling aspect. Mm-hmm. Maybe they think it's hokey. Yeah. Maybe they think that it could fail.
Well, that's what I think might be the biggest worry, is that this could go wrong.
This could go badly wrong.
And then we would be embarrassed in real time in front of everybody.
Well, there was a show some years ago in which a maker of a fireproof material did have permission to set himself on fire, set the material on fire, mm-hmm. and then he ran around under it. And it was a live demonstration. Now, I can't think of a more serious or a more catastrophic potential failure, but he had the faith in his product and knew that it would work. Now, I don't recommend people do death-defying feats, but on the other hand, I think if you're willing to put your product up to show this could fail, but it works. For instance, if you have an unbreakable glass, why not have everything sure. from a circus atmosphere, a circus strongman, quote unquote, smashing it with a sledgehammer, doesn't break, and yep. then attendees get to try their hand at it as well. There was a show a few years ago, Cannabusiness, here in Las Vegas, where one of the more common exhibitors there was for safes, because it's a cash business. Now, there were several safe makers. They had them all neat and pristine and new and lined up, just like new refrigerators almost. And they looked nice, but nothing's interesting me, except one guy who took one of his safes that had been in an attempted robbery. They had apparently tried to blowtorch and sledgehammer it open.
Yeah.
Failed. He had the story written on a placard. It was placed on the edge of the booth on top of this beat up, burned, smashed, but not broken into safe. And you could not help but stop, read the story, and see the proof right there. It was so simple, so engaging.
That's cool.
And it was dramatic.
I was just coming from a meeting before we had the start of this interview with one of our clients, and we're looking at doing a new thing for them, and they make pumps. So like large industrial pumps, and they're like the best in the industry, in their industry. And so we were having a conversation around, so many people that use their pumps never have to buy another one because they still have one from 1950 that, you know, and that's the story of like, they should consider bringing some of those old pumps into the booth right. to show people like, this is what it could look like in 50 years. It's still working fine. Yeah, a little dinged up here and there, but...
Well, that was 50 years ago. That was a long time. I think it's a great idea. And that's what we need more of. We need that dramatic storytelling, which I just see so many people passing on. And again, for a variety of reasons. I don't really know why, though, because the opportunities always seem to be there.
They do seem to be there. And sometimes you wonder if people just are defaulting to an easier, you know, solution. Let's use more technology. You know, we've gotten away from the eye contact and the human interaction. We were talking about with Terry Morrison, the use of screens and the eye contact, about how people rely on screens so much that I don't want to put words in your mouth, but you see that as an issue.
I see that as a huge issue because it's a default position because it's easy. And because we're now a screen-obsessed culture, Even our popular culture, the show Black Mirror, is all about the use of technology and screens in a Twilight Zone kind of ambiance, right? But as much as powerful as screens are, and as entertaining as they can be, again, when you take out the human element, what are you putting or leaving in exhibitions that's any different from sitting at home? Nothing, virtually nothing. And I liken the overuse of technology to dating. Now, hear me out on this.
Okay.
We have dozens and dozens of dating sites. There are dozens of apps relating to dating. There's a huge technological background, if you will, now, and infrastructure to dating. Does that replace the actual person-to-person date? No. It's meant to kind of lead up to it or to augment it, but it is in no way trying to replace it. Well, what we're doing often with the technology, I think, is actually trying to replace the human element, make it easier. Yes, it works to a degree, but I think there's a threshold where there's a point of diminishing returns, and you just do not get the feedback or the interest because everybody's got screens. Not everybody has great booth staff. Not everybody has a great story. Not everybody can do a great demonstration of their product. Those are huge differentiating factors.
If you want to reach out and connect with Charles, you can find him on LinkedIn or on Exhibitor Magazine's website or in our show notes here with the podcast. His book is also widely available through Amazon and many other places online. This has been part one of a two-part interview with Charles Pappas on the Global Exhibitor Podcast. Stay tuned for part two coming up soon.
We like to remind people that all business is conducted within the context of culture. So each episode provides insights to help marketers understand the cultures they're trying to reach and strategies for building bridges across cultural divides. If you like the Global Exhibitor podcast, please share it with others, subscribe to it, and rate it on iTunes. We greatly appreciate the feedback. Please also check out our website and blog at www.globalexhibitor.com. And finally, if you or someone you know would make an interesting guest on this podcast, please let us know by sending an email to guest@globalexhibitor.com. And until next time, thank you for listening.